Blog Talk Radio.
I was toting my pack along the dusty Winnemucca Road, when along came a semi with a high-end canvas-covered load. If you're going to Winnemucca, Mac, with me you can ride. And so I climbed into the cab and then I settled down inside. He asked me if I'd seen a road with so much dust and sand, and I said, listen, I've traveled every road in this here land. I've been everywhere, man, I've been everywhere, man. Across the deserts bare, man, I breathe the mountain air, man. Of travel I've had my share, man, I've been everywhere. I've been to Reno, Chicago, Fargo, Minnesota, Buffalo, Toronto, Winslow, Sarasota, Wichita, Tulsa, Ottawa, Oklahoma, Tampa, Panama, Mattawa, La Paloma, Bangor, Baltimore, Salvador, Amarillo, Tocopilla, Barranquilla, and Padilla. I'm a killer. I've been everywhere, man. I've been everywhere, man. Across the deserts, bare, man. I breathe the mountain air, man. Travel, I've had my share, man. I've been everywhere. I've been to Boston, Charleston, Dayton, Louisiana, Washington, Houston, Kingston, Texas, County, Monterey, Faraday.
It's time for the next edition of the Riveting Jumble Justice Radio Show, broadcast worldwide on Blog Talk Radio. Turn up your speakers and listen closely, since you may be asked questions later. Keep your phone handy, since we encourage you to call in your comments to the host and guests on today's show. The listener call-in number is 347-996-5983. Once again, the number is 347-996-5983. You will also find the number on the top of the homepage for the Jumble Justice Radio Show. I'm Audrey, your technical and spiritual advisor for the radio broadcast. And now, without further delay, allow me to introduce your eminently qualified and inspiring host for Jumble Justice, Professor Keith Haley.
Thank you very much, Audrey. Thank you one more time for getting us on the air. It's getting less complicated as we go, and Blog Talk Radio keeps making all sorts of improvements. Not that it was difficult in the past, but they do have a new studio and have a new look inside the website if you're a member and a broadcaster. So it really works out very nice. That's Audrey England, ladies and gentlemen. I'm sure you know that by now, but welcome to the Blog Talk Radio Network and the Jumble Justice Radio Show. I'm your host, Keith Haley, and we've got a good show on tonight. I think we're going to talk about something, or have a guest speaker talk about a subject that few people know much about, and that subject is snitching and its impact on the crime rates and the criminal justice system. It has some good impacts, but it has some negative ones, and there's some things about it we just don't know. And I think you'll find it very interesting. We're going to have a professor from Loyola Law School. Her name is Alexandra Natapoff, and she'll be talking about her book called Snitching, Criminal Information, and the Erosion of American Justice. So she takes a little negative shot at snitching, and I've always been a little suspect of it myself, but it does on occasion have good purposes, and she'll talk about that also. Mike, thank you much for being here. Mike Sorrento, and of course, Lucy Spears. The purpose of the show is what it always is, take an inside look at criminal justice, and this is a pretty good example here. We are going to look at some news issues and events and developments in criminal justice relating to this issue of snitching. And it's a very interesting subject. In case people don't know what I'm talking about, it means, you know, we won't arrest you if you'll tell us what somebody else is doing, and we'll let you stay out on the street and maybe continue committing your crimes if you'll give us information. There'll be enough to arrest and convict somebody else in their crimes that should be more serious, I would hope. So anyway, it's a very complicated subject. It's the underside of criminal justice. People don't see it. You don't hear anybody talk about it much, unless it's some big gangster case or something like that, or an FBI case. But it's a very regular practice, and so this should be very interesting. So we talk about the police and courts and corrections and juvenile justice professionals in these episodes, and that's the purpose of our radio show, Jumble Justice. Sometimes it is a little jumbled. With snitching, it can it can happen that way. We want to thank Alan Levy, the CEO of Blog Talk Radio, that makes it possible. And I was talking to a gentleman today and thinking about maybe another kind of radio show. And I said, you know, you can sign up probably in 3 minutes and be broadcasting on Blog Talk Radio Network. And it's absolutely free, and you can have thousands, tens of thousands of listeners all over the world, and it doesn't cost a penny. Unless you're doing it in what they call prime time, and that's like 7 to 10 o'clock, you have to pay a little bit of money. It's not much at all. But anyway, most people want to be not in those hours anyway. You know, do a midnight show or 11 o'clock or 6 p.m. or 8 a.m. or something like that if you can do it. We already talked about what tonight's show is, so we'll move on. Let's take a look at some blonde jokes. And ladies and gentlemen, tonight I'm going to do the blonde jokes myself. I'm going to take them from this book I bought at the bookstore. What's that stand for? BAM. Like, everybody knows, of course. But anyway, it's a great book. It's called Great One-Liners: Puns, Witticisms, and Laughs Galore. And it's edited and put together by Marcia Kimian. I think we talked about this last week, published by Platinum Press. And it is a great book. I mean, it's one that you can hardly put down. If you take it with you, you can read. You can read for 12 seconds. You can read for 12 minutes, or you can read for 12 hours if you want, and you still probably won't be done with the book, but it is really great. But she did isolate some blonde jokes in her book, and on page 74 of the book, she's got some she's got some real good ones. So let me go ahead, if you don't mind, Lucy, and I'll do the blonde jokes tonight. You heard about the dumb blonde, ? She called a guy to get his number. She put lipstick on her forehead because she wanted to make up her mind. She spent 20 minutes staring at the orange juice carton because it said concentrate. She asked for a price check at the dollar store. I've never been in a dollar store, but I guess it rings a dollar or less. She thought a quarterback was a refund. She tried to put M&Ms in alphabetical order. She took a ruler to bed to see how long she slept. She studied for a blood test. When she heard that over 50% of all accidents happen in the home, she moved. When she missed the number 44 bus, she took the number 22 bus twice. And, of course, last of all, there was the blonde who was taking her friend to the airport. She saw a sign that said, "Airport left." She turned around and went back home. Well, folks, it took you a little bit long to laugh there, didn't you? What, didn't you think they were funny? Did you have to think about it? Anyway, that's a good blonde joke. All right, let's do the Ohio Coalition against Firearms. And, of course, you know, they have a public service announcement. They still exist. And what they want you to do, I guess this message is directed toward you and I as law-abiding citizens, you and me, and they want us to turn in our firearms. So here's their public service announcement, as poignant as it is.
Carrying concealed handguns in Ohio? It's a deadly idea. A message from the Ohio Coalition Against Gun Violence.
It would be such a great thing if you turned in your firearms, and we as law-abiding citizens did that, and then only the criminals would be on the street. They'd be the only ones left. And then if we can get them to turn in theirs, then it would be good. But this must be directed toward the criminals, isn't it? I would think. Well, how about a green tip? This is a good one. I was going to get one out of Esme Floyd's book, 1001 Little Ways to Save the Planet, and we're still not done with all the tips in that book after years. But this was a good tip, I thought, or will be. I heard that the National Football League is now getting into some advertising and sponsorships. You know, they do the cancer thing, which is wonderful, the, you know, pink and prevent breast cancer and all that stuff. And they do something else. I can't remember what it is. But now they're going to get into saving the planet. I just heard that, and I don't know what it's actually going to be, but I think it's going to start this weekend. They're going to be doing some type of advertisements to help save the planet. And I get to thinking about that. If we want to prevent global warming, we want to save the planet, why don't we cancel or eliminate pro football? I don't know how many pro football teams there are now. Would you know, Mike? That's Audrey, Lucy. How many are there? There must be a couple dozen, I would think, at least, or pretty close to that. So if all those people, those hundreds of thousands of people, millions for total on a weekend, wouldn't go to those shows, wouldn't drive their cars, those games, wouldn't drive their cars there, they wouldn't use up all that energy, the scoreboard and the television and all that stuff, think of how that would prevent the planet from warming up. So my green tip for this week is let's stop pro football. Didn't you think that would work pretty good? Slim chance, correct? Slim chance. Okay, let's take a look at some of the news tonight. And one that's been kind of overworked, but we'll talk about it anyway tonight, is an interesting one. You've heard about this business called the knockout, right? Maybe we even talked about one of those stories last week, but this is a story out of Philadelphia. Knockout attacks have been reported in several states around the country, and now investigators believe three people have been attacked in Philadelphia. Police in Lower Merion, M-E-R-I-O-N, I haven't been to Philadelphia in 1,000 years, but I don't know how you pronounce that, but they're investigating two attacks in the area. And I think everybody knows what a knockout is. Some innocent person is walking down the street, paying normal attention to their surroundings, and a group of teenagers will walk by. Seems like they're all teenagers. That's what they say. I bet some are older than that. And this game is spreading across the country. And as they walk by or walk up behind somebody, they try to hit them with one punch and knock them out. And, of course, they score big if they knock them out. And you've seen videotapes by now on television. Go to YouTube. It's loaded with them. Just type in knockout, and you'll get all kinds of things relative to that. And the videos from cities around the country, they show people being punched and then beaten at random. And they're calling this a game, these guys. They think it's a game. And the one guy is a victim of a knockout assault here in Philadelphia. He said, someone asked me for a cigarette. And by the time I got my hands out of my pocket, I was getting hit by four kids. And they were trying to knock him out. I mean, this is really low class. And then I hear people explain this. Well, these are poor, deprived children. They don't have anything else to do. Are you kidding me? I don't have anything else to do but knock somebody out on the street. Well, I got a game that you can play with them. If they want to play knockout, why don't you play shoot up? Those of you who have a concealed carry license and four of them start beating you in the face, trying to knock you out, then you could play shoot up and see how well they like that game. I'll bet one of those would happen. We would hope they wouldn't be killed, but if one of those happened, I'll bet that might slow down the participation in the game called knockout. What do you think? Hey, this is a funny story. This is out of Sorrento, Louisiana. There's a police officer down there that's been caught speeding, and I'll tell you how he got caught. 737 times with no citation. In other words, nobody ever gave him a ticket. And people in that community are saying, we better take this guy off the road. The citizens are asking why this guy who hands out speeding tickets on his regular job, like candy, is exempt from the same laws that he so enthusiastically enforces. Officer James Bell, he wrecked a tax-subsidized vehicle in a crash where he was going more than 100 miles an hour. So that prompted investigators to take a look at this GPS recorder he had in his car. And when they looked at the GPS recorder, it revealed hundreds of excessive speeding incidents. Now, the afternoon of the crash, Bell's cruiser had repeatedly reached high rates of 109 and 106 miles per hour. So in 2 months' time, this is from like past July to this September, Bell drove his vehicle more than 75 miles per hour, a total of 735 times, oftentimes outside of town limits, outside his jurisdiction. So this guy, I think, is addicted to speeding. And the police chief down there, Police Chief Earl Thoreau, he gave Officer Bell a written reprimand and then walked away from the thing. But can you believe that? In the same 2 months, Officer Bell, are you ready for this, issued 300 speeding tickets. 100 speeding tickets. And yet he's been caught with this gadget doing 737 violations and no citations whatsoever. That is really a hoot. Let's skip the one about the Marines. There's one about the women Marines. You know, the three of them now have passed the Marine grunt test. The Marines say they still need two more years, but none of them have passed the officer's version. And what they want to do is, you know, there's laws and regulations that we want to fully integrate all units in the military with women. And the Marines have been the last one to kind of buy into this, and they're taking orders, and Marines are good at following orders, and they're not for it, essentially. And then I heard today, I didn't get all the story, something about women now want to wear makeup with her utilities, or what we call utilities, the fatigues, the kind of camouflage fatigue kind of things, and one of the services isn't in favor of that. I don't know if that was the Marine Corps or not, but you know, it's kind of something. And most of the Marines have said, well, somebody's quoted in this article saying, you know, we just don't want women in that type of, you know, strict combat type of situation, and they have to carry a pack. How much was the pack? What in the heck was it? They were going how many miles, but their pack was like 75 pounds. I think they had to go like 9 miles and who knows, maybe run or something like that. Only 7% of the Corps is female, half the overall rate for the U.S. military. So fewer women go into the Marines anyway because they probably figure they're going to be. And, of course, the Marines are always doing stuff that you never hear about in the news. I mean, good stuff for the nation. Okay. What are they stealing off the streets of New York? Well, Steve Jobs must have had it right, because Apple fanatic Winey just replaced her iPhone 5. When we asked her about it, if you didn't know any better, you might think she was talking about a family member, but she said it's her everything. But that's really troubling. The New York City Police Department said that in 2012, nearly 20% of all burglaries, robberies, and grand larcenies involved Apple products. Can you believe that? I would have never believed it. I mean, Steve Jobs, you know, he had it right. There's one thing about Apple. It works. I'm using one right now. And while I'm using, what am I using? I'm using two things that are Apple products right now, my computer and my iPhone. But anyway, 20% of all burglaries, robberies, and grand larcenies involved Apple products. That was in the year 2012. In total, about 16,000 Apple items were stolen. That's 14% of all the crime in the city. Can you believe that? I mean, what a way to, you know, that might be a way to set up criminals, right? Kind of leave some Apple products around and, you know, see what's going on. He said the items have high resale value. I wonder why. I know why, because they still work. You know, I can remember buying a computer every 2 or 3 years because the Windows stuff all, you know, went down the tube. But I've got my original Apple computers. I mean, they work just like they did the day I bought them, and I've had one of my Mac Air for 6 years, I think, something like that or longer, and it works absolutely perfect. let's take a look at a couple of the news stories. It takes too long to explain that, but Oakland's trying to go to the Super Domestic Domain Awareness Center. It's a super surveillance hub where they're going to monitor videos, they're going to look at gun, they're going to use gunshot detectors and license plate readers all over the city, and this stuff will all be shipped into cruisers, so cruisers can see all this stuff. It's probably already going on somewhere and we don't even know it. And then they're going to share all this information, and there's no guarantee, you know, who they're going to share it with, and some more of the stealth examination of people in public places and private places, and people are kind of against it. So we'll have to see how that thing turns out. Google continues to work on their driverless car. You've heard about that, and now they got one they think is going to fly. That's scary. We've entered the drone world. Fortunately, most of the world hasn't, but what did I say, like 14 nations now have drones, and just wait till we start seeing some. In fact, one of them crash off the West Coast here not too long ago, Mike? I think so, from a foreign country. I can't remember what nation that that was. But anyway, that is really something. How about this one? You saw the story where the FBI arrested the guys down in Bowling Green, Kentucky, several dozen suspected terrorist bombers who were brought here to the United States as refugees from Iraq and Afghanistan. Were busy. They were set up here. They even put them in public housing. And then they got involved with them, did some undercover work, and they were working on improvised explosive devices, that type of thing. And can you believe that? We set them up. We brought them here and set them up with all this stuff. Just wait till this stuff. I cannot predict what's going to go on in this counterterrorism business, but I think it's going to get work. And you know, we can go overboard on this, but on the other hand, we need some good, secure police and intelligence work to ward off these people. But isn't that incredible? And some of these guys, these two guys, they've killed American soldiers overseas. And now we put them up in public housing in Bowling Green, Kentucky. Why? I don't know. Google Glass is coming, still in experimental stage. Some special customers have a set of Google Glasses already. And Google Glasses is a little thing you wear, glasses over on the side, and I think on the right lens you can actually surf the Internet and do a number of other different things. So now people are wondering, when this thing goes public, I think they're going to start selling them. And is it as early as February? Maybe not until May or June or something like that. When they start selling these things, they're not going to be cheap. People are wondering, well, should I be allowed to drive my automobile while I'm wearing Google Glasses or Google Glass? And just think of that. Some guy's driving down the road, some woman's driving down the road, and talk about distractions. Here they'll be surfing the Internet with one eye, and they'll be blinking. You can control the thing with blinks and the movement of your eye right or left or something like that. It's going to be incredible. And we'll have accidents as a result of it for sure. I think the price will keep a lot of people away from it for a while. But just think, pretty soon we'll all have the same IQ as Wikipedia, right? I love to use the Wikipedia app on my iPhone and on my computers. And I mean, Wikipedia just keeps getting better and better. Of course, there are mistakes on it. But you can put in Donald Trump, put in Steve Jobs, name, put in, you know, Columbus, Ohio, or, you know, whatever, and you'll get pages and pages of documentation and research with citations about those particular subjects that you put in. So it's a fantastic thing, and you can actually get a nice little app for your iPad or your iPhone, and you probably get it on the Android system also, but it's something. Yeah, Google self-driving cars. I already talked about that, so I won't go any farther in it. We had an execution this week, and I'll stop with this one. White supremacist serial killer Joseph Paul Franklin has been put to death in Missouri. And that was done November 20th. It was done here, I guess, on the 20th. And he was 63 years old. He targeted blacks and Jews in a cross-country killing spree. Can people remember him from 1977 to 1980? He was executed Wednesday at the state prison in Bon Terre for killing Gerald Gordon in a sniper shooting outside of a suburban St. Louis synagogue. So he's still tracking Jewish people. What a terrible, terrible thing. So it took a long time to catch him, but they finally got him. And they got him with their new one-drug approach. They've been using the three-drug procedure for a long time. And states, I don't know how many states have done that. I haven't followed that much here in the last year or so. But Ohio shifted to the one-drug policy, too. And I think one drug, you just load them up. And they want a policy where there's a procedure where there's no pain. And the three-drug process, the second one actually, I think, hid concealed pain. And when the person was having pains, well, you know, who cares how many drugs it takes? But if one works, then that's fine. I will finish with this one. North Texas drivers were stopped at roadblocks. Have you heard about this? Drivers along a busy Fort Worth street on Friday, this past Friday, were stopped at a police roadblock and directed into a parking lot where they were asked by federal contractors for samples of their breath, their saliva, and even blood. It's part of a government research study aimed at determining the number of drunken or drug-impaired drivers. It just doesn't seem right, says Kim Cope, who said she was on her lunch break when she was forced to pull over at the roadblock on Beach Street in North Fort Worth. The National Highway Traffic Safety Administration, which is spending $7.9 million on the survey over 3 years, said participation was 100% voluntary. Well, cops pull you over, they start asking you for your blood and your saliva. Can you believe that? Yeah. I mean, they were asking for cheek swabs, $10 for that. Also, if you let them take your blood, they would pay you $50. At the very least, she said they wanted to test her breath for alcohol. She felt trapped. She took the breathalyzer test, and, of course, she passed, and that was the easiest way to get out of this thing. But do we need to be doing that? Do we need, we don't know that people out there are actually drinking and driving, but we need to spend $7.9 million? Well, the federal government may not know that. I never thought of that. So it's a new thing for them, but they could ask the local police, right? But I've never heard of anything like that in my life, and I think people should be turning down that option of giving their blood or their saliva. Absolutely incredible. Terrible. Okay, what we're going to do now, we're going to listen to a professor from Loyola, and what she's going to be doing is talking about snitching, and snitching just means that we're paying somebody off who will give us a crook off, who will give us more information about a crime. And give me a little time to set this up with booktv.org. Book is a wonderful website. Absolutely.
A law professor argues
here we go.
The practice of recruiting or persuading those accused of crimes to inform on other criminals, gain a lesser sentence, is eroding justice and leading to more crime. The Georgetown University Law Center in Washington, D.C. hosts this hour-long event.
Thank you. Thank you all for being here. Special thanks to Professor Mezzi for making this happen. And thank you also to the American Criminal Law Review for hosting me today. I've relied on the American Criminal Law Review for years. So it's really wonderful to get to come here and speak in this context. So I'm talking today about my new book, but in some more fundamental sense, I am talking about features of our criminal justice system that we rarely discuss. And snitching is everywhere in our criminal system. What do I mean by snitching? I'm referring to the very specific law enforcement practice of trading criminal guilt in exchange for information. And so this talk in this book is not about everyone who gives information to the government. It's not about the citizen who calls 911. It's not about even informants who work for money, although many do. But it's about the specific public policy of permitting the trade of potential criminal guilt in exchange for information and cooperation. And I say snitching is everywhere in our criminal system in the following sense. It touches on and bears on almost every facet of the criminal process as we know it. It takes place on street corners when the police officer has to decide whether to pressure a suspect into cooperating or whether to arrest them at that moment. It takes place in jails and prisons where inmates know that if they come forward with information, they may get a deal. It takes place, of course, in prosecutorial offices when prosecutors have to decide which suspect should be the witness and which one should be the defendant in any particular case. It shapes FBI investigations and other federal and local and state law enforcement investigations. Of course, it's a central feature of plea bargaining as we know it. And especially in the federal system, it's a crucial feature of sentencing, the decision of how much, if any, credit a defendant should get for any cooperation they should have rendered to the government. So it is in this sense that snitching is part of almost every piece of the criminal justice system, and this has deep implications for our legal system. It affects how we investigate crime. It affects who gets investigated for crime. It affects how we decide who is guilty and what they're guilty of and how they should be punished. And it affects people's perceptions of the legal system and their understanding of how law enforcement works. I'd like to start today the way I start the book, with a true story. Ninety-two-year-old Catherine Johnston was dead, which meant big trouble for Officer Smith and Junior. 3 hours earlier, everything had looked so promising. Atlanta police had busted Fabian Sheets for the third time in 4 months, and the local drug dealer turned informant them off to a major stash at 933 Neal Street, an entire kilo of cocaine. Sheets wasn't one of their registered informants, so they couldn't use him to get a warrant. But Smith and Junior applied for a warrant anyway by inventing an imaginary snitch. They called him a, quote, reliable confidential informant, unquote, and they told the magistrate judge that this non-existent snitch had bought crack cocaine at the Neal Street address. Well, the fabrication wouldn't matter in the end. After they got the warrant, busted in, and grabbed the kilo, it would be a major victory. But nothing went the way it was supposed to. Sheets' tip was bad. There was no cocaine at that address. Once inside the house, the officers opened fire. And now Mrs. Johnston was lying at their feet, riddled with police bullets, with no cocaine anywhere to be found. So Smith and Junior turned to one of their regular informants, yet another snitch named Alex White. They offered him $130 to say that he bought drugs at Mrs. Johnston's Neal Street home and to corroborate their false warrant applications. It wouldn't bring Mrs. Johnston back, but at least no one would learn that they'd gambled everything on a weak lead from the bad snitch and that the informant and the warrant didn't even exist. I start with this story not only because it's true and not only because it triggered a congressional investigation, which it did, but because it's paradigmatic in many ways of the snitching phenomenon. The story begins, of course, with the police letting a known criminal offender walk in exchange for information, and this is the heart of the snitching deal. It is precisely in this way that many criminal informants are able to avoid liability for their crime by providing information, and as it was in this story, all too often this information is inaccurate. The Atlanta police used their informant power both to rely on an unreliable snitch and to invent an informant to get a warrant because they knew with near certainty that their decision to do so would never be scrutinized by a court. It is rare for a magistrate judge to require police to verify the identity or the information from a confidential informant. And so although, as you know, we have many mechanisms for ensuring the accuracy of information in warrants, often criminal informant use slips beneath this protective radar. And finally, police in this story used their informant power to cover up their own mistake. And because informant use is so secretive and is so unregulated, easy for police and prosecutors to use informants in many ways to fill in gaps, to bolster shaky cases, to get a questionable warrant, and even to cover up errors, mistakes, or even wrongdoing on their own part. And so it is in this way that the tragedy of Mrs. Johnston's death tells us something about how our criminal system really works. I started by describing how criminal informant use touches on so many facets of our criminal justice system. But do we know more than that? Can we estimate how many criminal informants there really are in our system at any given time? And the first thing that needs to be said is that there is no direct data. There are no mechanisms to collect data on how many informants police and prosecutors create and rely on at any given time, what crimes they've committed, what crimes they've helped us solve. But we can piece together a more robust picture from data that we do know about how our criminal system works. And so one useful piece of data that people often turn to in this regard is federal sentencing data. The Sentencing Commission tells us that approximately 13 or 14% of all federal defendants receive some cooperation credit on the record in the form of a sentencing departure, at sentencing, and about a quarter of drug dependents. The Sentencing Commission also tells us that it believes that about half of cooperating defendants actually get credit for their cooperation. So if 25% of federal drug offenders actually get a sentencing departure, that means probably about 50% or somewhat more of drug defendants are actually cooperating. It's just that about half of them don't show up in the sentencing data. The Sentencing Commission also tells us that in every category of federal offense, criminal defendants receive cooperation credit, from child pornography to murder, as well as sort of the heartland cases of drugs and increasingly fraud and white-collar crime. So the entire federal criminal system is touched in these various ways by the power to turn a defendant into a cooperator. The problem with this data is that it's partial in any number of ways. First of all, it doesn't include most of the cooperation that we know about. In effect, it's the tip of the iceberg, of course. It doesn't include defendants who cooperate but don't get credit. But it doesn't include all those defendants who avoid being arrested or prosecuted in the first place by cooperating. It doesn't account for dropped charges or other benefits that cooperators might get, as well as a host of other kinds of benefits, such as immigration considerations and, of course, money and other payments. So it is, at best, a partial picture of cooperation in the federal system. And the federal system is actually quite a small percentage of our entire criminal justice system. It represents about a tenth of felony cases. 90% of all cases take place at the state level. So for what it's worth, the federal data gives us a glimpse, but a very partial one. We can, however, more generally, use drug enforcement itself as a rough proxy for figuring out how prevalent the use of the criminal informants really is in our system, because we know that informant use is at the heart of drug investigations, negotiations, plea bargaining, and sentencing. It's sometimes jested that every drug case involves a snitch, but anybody who's worked in the criminal justice system knows that it is par for the course for any number of the parts of a drug investigation to rely on or involve informants in some way. Well, that's about 30% of our criminal justice system. Drug cases make up approximately 30% of both federal and state dockets. And so we're talking about a significant portion of our system overall that is openly reliant on criminal informant use. And, of course, as we know from reading the paper about every 2 weeks, we see that criminal informant use is also becoming a more prevalent tactic in white-collar offenses, in fraud, hedge fund investigations, and other arenas like that. So, well, we have a core area of informant use, and that use is spreading. So what we get is a dual dynamic, an important, powerful criminal justice tool that is used widely throughout the criminal system that determines the outcomes of thousands of investigations and cases, and yet which is at the same time deeply unregulated, never comes to public scrutiny. In my view, this would make snitching interesting all by itself. But there is one more piece of the puzzle, and that is that the big overlooked cost of using criminal informants in the ways that we do is its impact on poor African-American neighbors. And this, too, is connected with the prevalence of the use of informants in drug enforcement. Because drug enforcement resources are so heavily concentrated in poor urban neighborhoods, we should expect the use of informants to be likewise deeply concentrated. And this has implications for those neighborhoods as well. What is the scale of the phenomenon that we're talking about? Well, again, we have no direct data. State and local law enforcement agencies do not collect data on the informants that they use or the crimes that are committed or solved by them. But we do know a lot, relatively a lot, about how drug enforcement works and the criminal justice system works in urban communities. Nationally, we know that approximately 30% of young African American men between the ages of 20 and 29 are under criminal justice supervision at any given time. By itself, of course, a staggering number. but also a misleading number, right? Because it's a national average. So it's masking differences between different communities. There are going to be some communities in which that number is much, much lower. At the same time, there are going to be communities in which that number is significantly higher. For example, here in Washington, D.C., in Baltimore, studies have shown that as many as half of the young men of that age range in any particular community might well be under criminal justice supervision at any given time. We think that about half of those people are under criminal justice supervision for drug-related reasons. And when I say drug-related, I mean either they're under supervision because they've actually committed a drug offense, buying or selling drugs, but they may have committed a drug-related offense in the sense that they commit a property offense as a result of their substance abuse problem. And a high proportion of Americans who are currently in jail or in prison committed their offenses in order to get money for drugs to feed their substance abuse habits. And so half of that population, the population that is in connection with the criminal justice system because of drug use or because of a drug offense, this is an arena in which we would expect law enforcement to put pressure on suspects to become informants, because we know that this is typically how police handle these kinds of cases. So this quarter of the population is in a sense sort of high-risk snitch arena. How many of these people actually become informants? Because, of course, the pressure to become an informant and actually choosing to do it, particularly in this world where becoming an informant can be high risk, is quite a different matter. And we can't know that directly. The police don't tell us. Perhaps not surprisingly, the offenders don't tell us. But we can make good guesses for the sake of argument. And I told you a few minutes ago that at the federal level, we know that approximately 50% of drug informants cooperate. So let's say that at the state and local level, it's half of that, right? That 25% of drug defendants cooperate in some way. If that were true, that would mean that about 1 in 16 of the young men of this age range in these neighborhoods is actually a criminal informant at any given time, about 6%. And 6% would be a lot. That's a lot of people in a community, in a family. Just by way of contrast, it's often said that approximately 10% of the East German population before the fall of communism were working as informants in some way with the Stasi secret police. And we often look at that society as a dysfunctional society precisely because we think that's an extremely high percentage of people who would be to be working with the government at any given time in that way. So 6% would be a lot. And so in these neighborhoods, it does not make sense to understand the use of criminal informants solely as a law enforcement tactic or as an investigative tool. On this scale, it becomes a form of social policy. It affects how people interact with each other, how they understand each other, and of course how they perceive the criminal justice system. What might this effect look like? Well, back in 1998, I was working in Baltimore. I had a fellowship from the Open Society Institute to do community lawyering work, and part of that fellowship involved teaching law classes in inner-city Baltimore neighborhoods. And one night, I was teaching such a class at a community center, and I'm sure that most of the students weren't listening to me, but there was one student who raised his hand, and he said, "I had a question." He was maybe about 12 or 13 years old. He said, "I got a question. So police let dealers stay on the corner because they're snitching. Can they do that? Can the police do that? Is that legal?" And when I explained to him that it was legal and that police have discretion to arrest or not to arrest offenders, he and his friends were disgusted. They said, "Oh, the police aren't doing their job." And one said, "Oh, well, all you got to do is snitch and you can keep on dealing." And so for me personally, this showed me that it's important to understand that snitching has deeper implications and goes deeper than just the criminal justice system lets us know, that our criminal system sends messages to young people and to communities that can affect far deeper aspects of life than we think of when we think of them in law enforcement terms. So what to do? We have a system-wide phenomenon, and it raises systemic challenges. Before I talk about the central challenges that I think can help us organize our thinking about this phenomenon, I want to acknowledge that snitching is also an extremely powerful law enforcement tool, right? It's one of the only ways that law enforcement can often penetrate criminal organizations, gangs, Enron, terrorist cells. It is sometimes the only way for the government to work its way up the hierarchy of criminal offenders is to flip lower-level actors. And so I don't want to miss the value of this tool towards law enforcement ends and towards the appropriate end of punishing or forestalling crime. At the same time, we have radically underestimated the costs and dangers of this practice. While the system is well familiar with the benefits, the potential benefits of the practice, and many features of our law actually protect and promote those benefits, I think it's time to turn with equal respect to the dangers that this phenomenon promotes. So what are the great challenges? Well, first and foremost, and probably the best known, is the challenge of unreliability. We know that informants often give unreliable information. It's in their interest to give unreliable information when their own lives and sentences are on the line. A few years ago, Northwestern Law School issued a study. Their Center for Wrongful Conviction studied all of the wrongful capital convictions about which we know. And they concluded that over 45% of those innocent people who had ended up on death row had ended up there because of the false testimony of a lying informant, making snitching the largest single source of error in U.S. capital convictions. What this statistic says to me is not only that snitches are unreliable, but also that police and prosecutors rely on them, and that when these cases go to trial, juries believe them. So there's a way in which our system is not well protected against the dangers of unreliable informant information. And while unreliability is a terrible problem, particularly when it leads to wrongful convictions, there is perhaps a more fundamental challenge, which is that snitching, in many ways, turns our criminal justice system on its head because it prizes information over the prosecution of crime. Usually, we think of law enforcement as obtaining information in order to arrest and prosecute or deter wrongdoers and to find out who they are. But criminal informant use flips that on its head and permits the government to use its power over liability to ignore crime or even tolerate crime in order to protect its information sources. The use of a criminal informant inherently requires the toleration of crime. Of course, first it requires the toleration of the crime that the informant already committed. That's the snitch deal. We let you off in exchange for information. Active informants, however, typically, particularly in drug enforcement, continue to commit offenses in order to generate more information in ways that are authorized by the government. So the Department of Justice has a series of iterations of guidelines for the use of informants in the criminal system, and the guidelines that govern the FBI provide for two tiers of criminal activity that can be authorized by a handler, Tier 1 and Tier 2. Tier 1 includes selling drugs with no expectation of their recovery, engaging in acts that might lead to somebody else committing an act of violence, serious offenses, and Tier 2 are all other crimes, on the recognition that informant handlers are going to authorize their informants to commit more crimes, above and beyond crimes that they've already committed. And even above and beyond these two, police and prosecutors routinely acknowledge with concern criminal informants will often continue offending, knowing that their relationship with the government will provide them some protection and some leeway in the event that they get caught. And all too often, law enforcement considers this sort of the cost of doing business in the dirty world of using informants. Perhaps the most infamous example was the FBI's long-running debacle in its handling of its mafia informants. particularly in Boston, but also elsewhere, two Irish mob informants named Whitey Bulger and Stephen the Rifleman Fleming. You know, when you work with someone whose middle name is Rifleman, you're asking for trouble. They worked with the FBI for decades in Boston, and they were considered such valuable sources of information that their handlers, particularly FBI agent John Connolly, covered for them as they committed murder, racketeering, money laundering. Connolly himself is serving 10 years now for conspiracy and racketeering charges. But Congress called this episode one of the worst in FBI history, and it shouldn't surprise us that the episode involved the agency's heavy reliance on criminal informants. The crimes that informants commit need not be this dramatic. It is routine practice in drug enforcement for police and agents to understand that their informants will continue their illegal drug use and can often continue their illegal drug dealing. Many police and prosecutors acknowledge that they expect their informants to so-called skim drugs off the top of controlled buys, either for their own use or for resale. And again, many informants use their relationship with the government to ease their way around liability for other crimes that they commit. So we have an investigative technique that requires the government to tolerate or ignore crimes. And particularly in high crime neighborhoods where informants are remaining at large, remaining at home because of their cooperation, the cost of these crimes are borne by the community. They are borne by the friends and the families and the neighbors of the people who come home and continue to commit these offenses. And this is a hidden cost of informing that is rarely counted in the calculus of whether and when this is a good public policy or not. I would note, just by way of comparison, that some European countries have rejected this compromise. Decided that the government shouldn't be in the business of tolerating and promoting crime. And in those countries, there are much stricter restrictions on how law enforcement can use informants and what crimes an informant can work off by providing information. So ours is not the only way of handling this problem. The final great challenge, I think, of using criminal informants is its effect on the transparency and accountability of our criminal justice system. In general. In effect, a snitching deal is a way of resolving a person's criminal liability off the record and under the table in direct negotiations with a police officer or sometimes a prosecutor. And this flies in the face of many of our most cherished principles of criminal justice, whether it's the idea of the public trial or due process, or even the idea that the public should know how criminal offenders are being handled by our government. Because snitching is so secretive, it means that not only the public, but courts and legislatures are unlikely to ever learn the actual way that the criminal law is being enforced. And this is a significant cost of using criminal informants that also tends to go unaccounted for. So I want to leave plenty of time for discussion. So in the interest of time, I want to end by talking about the possibilities of reform. I devoted an entire chapter of the book to it. It's a very exciting time for reform in the world of informants. There are a number of states who are taking on different ways of looking at this question, but I want to mention just one. But before I do that, I want to explain why I talk about reform in the way I do. For example, I don't advocate banning the practice of using informants, and given the tone of the last half hour, you might legitimately ask me why. It's because the use of informants are part of much deeper choices that we have made about the way we structure criminal justice. Essentially, the kinds of police and prosecutorial discretion that we permit, and plea bargaining. We invest police and prosecutors with vast discretion in our justice system. We depend on their discretion to decide who to arrest, and most importantly for these purposes, often who not to arrest, who to charge, and who not to charge. Well, as long as police and prosecutors have that authority to choose, then they have the authority not to arrest or prosecute useful suspects. So the ability to create an informant is something built into the discretionary world that we've created. Likewise, plea bargaining. 95% of all American felony cases are resolved by plea. They're negotiated. They don't go to trial. We are a largely negotiated criminal system. And so if you can negotiate, then you can negotiate over information. And so it's in this sense that our criminal system naturally turns towards snitching. And so the reforms that I propose in the book accept this reality. They attempt to work within the framework of the criminal justice system we have on the theory that we could use criminal informants nonetheless in a more reliable, accurate, fair, and transparent way. I think the most important reform that would enable us to get a better grip on this phenomenon is an informational reform. Currently, nobody, not even Attorney General Holder, knows how many snitches are in the system. Nobody knows how many crimes they commit, how many crimes they're forgiven for, and how many crimes they solve. And so there is no rational way for us to evaluate this practice either in general or in specific communities or for specific kinds of crime, because we simply lack the information about its costs and benefits on balance. And I should say that the federal government, of all the jurisdictions, is in the lead in this regard. The Department of Justice, as I mentioned, has issued guidelines for its investigative agencies about how informants can be created and used and, most importantly, kept track of. So now, although it didn't a decade ago, the FBI is now required to keep track of how many crimes its informants commit, as well as how much investigative productivity they confer on any given case. And so the federal government has begun to create mechanisms by which we could rationally evaluate whether these informants are doing the kinds of jobs that we want and what their costs and risks are. And so if states and localities were to follow the lead of the federal government, even in this small regard, it would represent a huge step forward in our ability to evaluate this public policy.
Well, Professor, Nada Poth is ready to take questions, so you've heard essentially her presentation. A real good look, the book, at something that many people know very little about, and we're just now starting to uncover this, and her book is sort of a watershed movement in that regard, and she's done some excellent research. You can get the rest of the course on booktv.org, and the title of the book is Snitching. Snitching, the subtitle is Criminal Informants and the Erosion of American Justice by Alexandra Natapoff. That's Natapoff. Well, that does it for tonight. What we'll do is have Vera Lynn sign us off, as she usually does, singing What? We'll Meet Again.
We'll meet again. Don't know where, don't know when, but I know we'll meet again some sunny day. Keep smiling through, just like you always do, till the blue skies drive the dark clouds far away. So will you please say hello to the folks that I know? Tell them I won't be long. They'll be happy to know that as you saw me go, I was singing this song. Again, don't know where, don't know when, but I know we'll meet again some sunny day.